This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hi guys, how are you?
All good, thanks, Claire. How are you?
Nice to see you. I'm all right.
Yeah.
How are you, Rob?
I'm good, thank you.
You've got quite a husky voice this morning.
Lost my voice because, I used it up last night. You might be aware I am now a celebrity TV chef. So it's kind of another string to the boat.
You are. Tell everyone who didn't see the Instagram live what happened.
Well, I think after the torrent of abuse I got on the last episode for not fulfilling my promise, we went through it. So last night, Barry and I did a cook-along. So the people spoke and they wanted to hear Barry's tuna burger recipe. So if you jump on our Instagram, you'll actually see the full thing up there. Barry was head chef. I was apprentice. It went largely fine. The smoke alarm did go off near the end. I was actually pretty pleased with the result, to be honest. For a first run out, and done with my phone in the kitchen, I thought it was all right. So, but time will tell. On that point, I was expecting, honestly, I was going into it. I said to Barry, I said, this is going to be really awkward if there's like two people on there. We had like 60 people watching at once.
60 people
which
watching.
Absolutely blows my mind.
Impressive.
60 people around the world tuned in to watch me and Barry cook tuna burgers.
And the restrictions have eased. So they've got other things they could be doing.
Exactly.
That's true. And the weather was all right as well.
Weather was all right, exactly. I mean, imagine if it was locked down, or like a rainy lockdown. We'd have had probably 70.
You'd have broke the internet. So,
but no, do you know what? It was good fun. And don't forget, if you're listening and you did do the cook-along bit, because I did post that, I think in theory there were some people making it along.
Doing it with you.
But I don't know. So put your pictures on Instagram, you know, the little taggers at Banged Up Podcast.
And did you take a picture? Creations.
I took a picture of ours and they tasted better than they looked, is all I'll say about mine.
Whose looked better, yours or Barry's?
But we did it full authentic. Barry didn't make them, actually. No, Barry didn't make them. We felt it would be a bit complicated, both of us doing it.
Oh,
he's also vegan now, so he doesn't eat tuna.
Is he vegan?
I've not heard this. He's gone full vegan, yeah. So Athena, his fiance, is vegan and he has joined her. He showed a bit of solidarity, but he was funny actually, and he was telling me so he kind of very tentatively had sent out the podcast to a couple of mates, and then I think by the time yesterday he'd posted about it and he had some feedback from some of his mates, kind of traveler mates from the community, and I think the feedback was good. He was so nervous about it. But no, I think he got some really good feedback from it. He was really happy about
it.
He seems to have, got away with pointing out that gypsies have a gaydar so far. So he's he was really happy and he was on good form. So yeah, the full cook along, you haven't missed it. You haven't missed your chance. The full cook along is on our Instagram on the grid. So yeah, jump on and have a look at that.
Brilliant. Well done, Rob. I'm well impressed.
You know, well done, to be fair. Yeah, well done. When I saw the post, I was like, you know, we actually did it. I thought he was going to...
What happened was you saw the post and you thought, busy. And then you said...
Yeah, obviously, yeah. But I thought you actually did it. I was surprised, to be fair.
You're up next, boats.
Yeah, good one. Yeah, but anyway...
The public want to see your face.
Yeah, maybe one day.
Also, I think you owe the public some screen time after this episode that's about to follow. We don't hear from you in this one, boats.
Well, who we got next? Who we got next? I can't even remember. Yeah.
If you thought you heard not a lot from boats in our normal episodes, this is a pearler, because I don't know if we get one word out of you on this one.
Who is next?
We've got Peter. So Peter spent 6 months as a special advisor to Justice Secretary Robert Buckland. And before that, he was a journalist for 10 years. And since then, he's written a book about his experiences in the government. So people, if they like this episode, they can go and read more from him. But I'm not sure you'll be buying that book, Boat.
To be fair, when you were just saying that, I was just thinking he's very relatable to me. So
that's it. Talk him up, mate.
Yeah. Rob stitched me up a bit in this episode. He kept asking my opinions, of which were not always in line with Peter's, and I had to stay very neutral.
Typical Robert.
Yeah. Well, I think this is being framed rather unfairly. I was not throwing you under the bus. See, I'm damned if I do, damned if I don't. If I just talk, I'm talking. I was trying to draw you into the conversation.
No, that's true. I just needed
to. You didn't try to draw me in, though, did you?
And I wanted to see, you and our Tory friend going at it.
Put me at a dinner party with Peter, and would have had a. There'd have been some.
That's what we should have done. We should next time we have a Tory on, we'll just give you three glasses of wine before we record.
Yeah,
and sparks will fly.
She can drink now as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Boats is on it.
We'll have him back. Yeah. Right, let's kick off with it then. So here it is. Peter begins by explaining to us what the role of a special advisor is.
So it's an interesting job, and of course there are the experts and the civil servants who are all impartial. There are hundreds, sometimes thousands of them in every government department. And of course they could work for any government. They could continue working for the Conservatives, or say in 2024 Keir Starmer becomes Prime Minister, they could then work for his administration as well. Special advisors, there's about 115 of them in government, compared to about 96,000 civil servants in Westminster. So special advisors are political advisors. They're members of the political party. They're there to give political advice. They're there to say, this will work well with the backbenchers. This will be politically popular. This will help you down the line. And often we think in a much more short-term way, because the civil servants, of course, are thinking 5 years, 10 years, whereas ministers, as we know, will change very, very rapidly. There's a reshuffle almost every year. So the average time, in my experience anyway, with the last few governments that ministers have lasted in different departments is about 18 months to 2 years. So you need to sort of think very, very carefully about what you actually want to achieve in that time. But I was, in terms of special advisors, there are generally two types. There are policy advisors who, in the Ministry of Justice, I worked with a great guy called Rajiv Shah, who's a PhD in law and knows the criminal justice system very well. He worked for in the Court of Appeal. And then there was me, who was there as sort of the media special advisor, so dealing with all sorts of media-related issues. The issue of terrorists in prison, for example, or people being radicalised in prison, is one that I really got into and really found very, very interesting. And I helped deal a little bit with the Downing Street people, with people like Dominic Cummings, who I'm sure many people will have heard of, and Boris Johnson. At the cabinet table, we were talking about the response to the Streatham attack, a guy who just got out of prison, who then attacked people with knives, for example. He'd been radicalised in prison, wasn't originally sent to prison for a terrorist offence. That whole issue is really interesting as well. So you get into all that kind of stuff as well. But also you get into the really kind of crazy stuff, like any, you know, media queries that come in. There is a press office staffed by very, very good civil servants. But I remember, you know, the sort of celebrity prisoners, I suppose, people like Rose West and Charles Bronson, people like that. There are always lots of bits of information, journalists asking questions about them, what they're up to. They're all everything from big policy decisions about what we're going to do about sentencing to things about, you know, I remember we got an inquiry about Rose West apparently complaining because she couldn't sleep because in the headline in the Daily Star, I think, was "Noisy Lags Keep Rose Awake" or something like that. So you go from the sublime to the ridiculous. It's a really interesting job. I loved it. And Justice was just one of the four departments I worked in. I worked in the Home Office for a very short time as well with Amber Rudd, then the Home Secretary. So criminal justice from the policing side as well.
When you deal with someone like, you know, we were not talking specifically, but as you see it, kind of a justice secretary, how much do you think their role is, you know, in terms of their perspective, are they trying to affect change within the system, or are they immediately looking at it, what's going to be a popular move to keep me in place or that's going to reflect well on the Conservative Party?
The second one.
Yeah.
The politicians are always interested in survival. They're interested in how they look and they're interested in the next election and whether people are going to continue to vote for the Conservative, in this case, the Conservative Party. So it's a really interesting one. I think you have, you know, genuine reformers, for example, like Ken Clark, for example, who would have been very much on the Liberal side of the Conservative Party. But in recent years, and I'm sure Robert, who's still a friend of mine, wouldn't mind me saying this, but I mean, there is a short-termism to it. You do want to affect change. You do want it to be better. You want the system to work better. But at the end of the day, if you're not voted in, if you're not kept in that role, and if the government isn't kept in that role, well, then it'll go to your political opponents and things will happen that you're not happy about. So there's a very fine balance between doing what's right, and I hope we did that, but also doing what is palatable to the public. And a lot of the time, my role as the media special advisor was to try to translate why we were necessarily doing something to the public's consciousness, because so many people, you know, homelessness was another issue I thought about. I worked on the Ministry of Housing, for example, and one of the issues I worked on there was housing for ex-prisoners. Now, it makes perfect sense to make sure that prisoners are not released from prison on a Friday afternoon when there aren't any services, when there isn't a job centre, when there isn't the housing services, and guess what? You know, they meet up with either drug dealers at the gate or sofa surf or whatever. I don't have somewhere proper to live. They fall into a life of crime again and then go back to prison. And as we all know, it costs a lot of money to put someone in prison, more than it costs to send someone to Eton. Certainly in terms of youth offenders, you know, you have young offenders institutions where it can cost up to £170,000 a year to keep one prisoner, one young person in that institution. So there is a very strong and very simple economic argument to say, well, why don't we put some money into making sure prisoners are housed? Why don't we make sure they have somewhere to go? Why don't we make sure they have a roof over their head? Because having a roof over your head and having a job are two major, major reasons why you're not going to reoffend, because you're going to have some stability, you're going to have some stake in society, and you're going to, you know, you're going to pay taxes, and you're going to be a worthwhile member of society rather than someone who's breaking the law and making people's lives a misery. So my point was, within that, why don't we sell this as a conservative argument in terms of saying these people are actually repaying their debt to society because they're actually contributing now, and we need to help them at the start of that. Of course we do. But unless there's some form of rehabilitation, and that includes giving people somewhere to live, when often many, many prisoners, as you guys will know far better than I do, don't have the kind of family structure that so many people have, don't have that kind of support network, let's try and give them that so they don't go back to prison, because that will cost the taxpayer more. But that kind of argument is pretty simple but slightly sophisticated. But then you have, you know, the tabloid newspapers going, you know, lags, you know, ex-cons being prioritized for housing over people who need it and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes, you know, it can be very hard to kind of sell those arguments politically, even though they make perfect sense.
Where do you think you met the most resistance with that stuff? Was it within the party or was that within the media and the wider public?
Bit of both, bit of all of those things, really. I think there are pilots that I was really happy to be part of in terms of the three pilots, I think, at the moment, in terms of meeting prisoners at the gate, making sure there's somewhere to go. And that, to my mind, should be ruled out nationally. But I think any form of helping prisoners, any form of rehabilitation, is always resisted by the public, who sort of say, why should we be paying money for this? You know, why should prisons be easy? I knew someone who was mugged and it was the worst experience of their life. Why should that person be helped? Especially actually from people who really do, who are maybe at the lower end of society, who sort of think, well, actually, I work really hard and my life isn't that good. So why should someone else be given money, time and resources so their life is better? And that's a really tough argument to get out there. Also, you know, people who pay, you know, maybe a bit further up society, maybe pay more money in tax, or say, well, why are my taxes going there when it should be on the NHS or something like that, which is a very, very simple argument, not a particularly sophisticated one, because there's lots of money spent on the NHS and other things. And also this kind of idea of kind of investing in criminal justice to therefore stop people continuing to be in the system is something that really needs to be, I think we just need to have a grown-up conversation as a society about it. But it's similar to homelessness. People think they understand homelessness. They don't. People think they understand prisons. They don't. Even I would say, I don't understand prisons. I don't understand criminal justice. But it's one of those things, the more you know, the less you know. And I think people have a very clear idea in their mind, especially if they don't know anybody in prison, if they don't necessarily, if they've never been themselves or even been a victim of crime themselves. But the reality is, as you know far better than I do, and what I picked up a little bit was that it's so nuanced, it's so incredibly difficult. And, you know, the idea, maybe we'll talk about this a bit later, but, you know, there's so many people in prison who should be in receiving treatment for mental health conditions, for example, rather than being in prison.
Yeah. Claire, would you agree with that, that the kind of more you know, you less you know, and it becomes kind of more complicated the more you go into the system?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying in terms of the sort of public perception of things is very different to when you dig a bit deeper in it and thinking about things, you know, in that wider sense and in a less individualistic point of view. And I guess one of the things that you said there that I'm interested in is, did you have any knowledge, or what knowledge did you have of the area of criminal justice in general or prisons before you took on that role with the Justice Minister?
Not a huge knowledge, to be honest. And as I say, I was a political advisor. You know, there are lots of people there who had the civil servants who had years and years and years of knowledge of prisons specifically, or the court service or whatever. And that was their job to know all that. And I was there to guide Robert kind of politically. So not a huge amount, I must be said. I'd always had prisons in particular is something and courts is something I've always been really interested in. I don't have a law degree. I've never wanted to be, you know, solicitor, barrister or anything like that. But the kind of outcomes and the idea of criminal justice has always been really interesting to me, probably through Newsnight and Question Time as well. But also I've interviewed a lot of ex-prisoners. I used to always read Erwin James's column, for example, in The Guardian. I've read a number of kind of, I always think that the greatest thing any, you know, the greatest phenomenon in our society is when a middle class person goes to prison and doesn't write a book about it. You know, that's really a really strange thing, because there's so many people who write.
You're looking
memoirs.
At one right there.
Oh, yeah, going to prison.
It's not too late, Rob.
Well, if anyone's listening, if Peter's got any connections, I'm open to it. Any publishers, please feel free to get in touch.
And you know, all those things, often those serializations and stuff you see of various people in the papers of Jeffrey Archer and people like that. I was always been kind of fascinated by watched a lot of films and documentaries and stuff about what prison's really like. So I suppose, I mean, I went to the housing department. I knew very, very little about housing. I know a lot more about it now. But with justice, there was a genuine interest there. And actually, of all the kind of policy areas I dealt with, I was in four departments: Home Office, Ministry of Justice, Housing, and Northern Ireland. You know, justice was definitely the one that everybody has. Everybody has an opinion on prisons. Everybody has an opinion on the court service and criminal justice.
Definitely.
So that was the one that was probably most relevant to people's lives.
Presumably, the first time you went into prison, was that through this role, through this job, or did it live up to what you thought it would be like, or what was different or similar about what you saw to what you anticipated?
Yeah, in fact, the first time I was in a prison was with those Newsnight programs, the first Newsnight program. So Highdown was the first prison I was in. I've also been to, Wormwood Scrubs, spent a lot of time in Wormwood Scrubs, actually, lots of visits in regard to making that Question Time program. And then Belmarsh was the main prison I'd been in the Ministry of Justice. And there are a couple of other prisons I've been to as well. I've also been to a prison in Camden in New Jersey. I think it's the New Jersey State Prison, actually, where I interviewed a Vietnam veteran who was, who is a double murderer. And it was really interesting to talk to him and his belief, never diagnosed, but his belief that PTSD was a big factor in his crime. So what was really interesting, I think, for me was, and has always been interesting, is sort of PTSD and veterans returning and the issue of veterans. And that comes into my interest in homelessness as well. So that was really, really interesting place to go to in sort of the American system, seeing the very, very stark nature of prisons there. I mean, prisons in my limited experience are pretty stark places anyway, but certainly the New Jersey State Prison was probably the most stark. I remember it was also a really horrible day. It was one of those really, really wet and horribly dark days. And it was almost like the weather was similar to the atmosphere inside the prison.
Yeah, I've never been to an American prison, but the impression I get is they are significantly worse than UK prisons across the board. I mean, I didn't go to any particularly nice ones. Rochester was right, but Highdown and Wandsworth are both pretty bleak. But I think, yeah, from conversations with people that have been out there and just, yeah, generally seeing them, I think they seem significantly worse. Going back to what you talked about, I had a question about the kind of current system, and this is kind of a bit of a bigger picture one, but in terms of kind of that system of having, you know, the civil servants that are working kind of and have the knowledge, and then kind of every 2-4 years, 18 months, whatever it is, you've got a new justice secretary coming in or a new political party coming in with their own views on like how to direct the justice system. Do you see a realistic way of that changing or improving?
I think what is often, David Cameron, certainly when he was prime minister, decided that he was going to have the same people in roles for a long time. And a lot of secretaries of state were in their roles for 5 years or perhaps longer when he was prime minister. And that's probably quite a good idea. I think what's useful as well is to have, you know, longer terms for governments. Some governments in different parts of the world have 7 years rather than our usual five. But the manifesto, of course, in terms of what people want to do, that's what political parties are voted in for. And I think you've got to follow the manifesto. You can't necessarily come in as a new justice secretary and say, right, well, I'm going to completely do things completely differently. And change takes a lot of time as well. So I think that the scope and the number of changes that you can actually enact is probably pretty low. And what I would always say to politicians, and I always did say to politicians, was, you know, you can do two or three proper things and properly see them through during your time in government. Choose them very, very carefully. And you've got to sort of work backwards and see when your kind of milestones are. So in terms of real change, I think it does happen. I do think that the civil service as well, there's a huge body of knowledge there. There's a lot of people with a lot of experience who are at the senior levels of Her Majesty's Prison and Probation Service. There's a guy I work with very closely called Jack Cole, who's just been now the Director of Prison Policy, who's an incredibly intelligent, incredibly hardworking, very dedicated guy. And I think he's going to do a brilliant job over the next few years as well. And I think I'm very confident things are going to get better for both those, for prison officers and for people in prison as well.
Did you experience in your time there, did you experience much of say one thing, do another in terms of, you know?
Not really, no. I think it's interesting in terms of the, you know, you can draw a direct line, a long line, but nonetheless a direct line between the Justice Secretary to, you know, a prison officer on a wing, which is strange because, you know, in the NHS, for example, that's not the case. It's basically an arm's length body of the Department of Health, and it's a bit more complicated in terms of that relationship. So the operational responsibility is there, and I think there's a lot of responsibility there. What is very difficult, of course, is to, you know, everybody's experience in prison is different. Every prison officer's experience is different. I think we don't pay them enough. I think we don't treat them well enough. I think it's a really, really tough, really dangerous job. And I think there are a lot of very, very good people who do that job. There are obviously a lot of people who aren't very good. There are some people who are corrupt, some people who are bad at their job, and we need to make sure that they're not on the wings. But I also think that, especially now, the Conservative government quite rightly is recruiting 20,000 additional police officers. You're going to see a lot of young, pretty talented prison officers saying, well, hold on a second, being a police officer, they're recruiting for all these jobs. My job is, you know, it's an equally secure job. It's less dangerous and you get paid more money. So why wouldn't I go into the police? So I think there's a major issue there. It's good that they'll attract good people to be in the police, but I think in terms of working conditions, in terms of pay, in terms of how we value prison officers, we need to think really, really carefully about that because you need the right people in those jobs as well.
Absolutely. I think if we then went one up from that, So you talked about how you'd had conversations with Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings. How important do you think those guys at the very top see this issue of prisons? Is it, you know, where does that sit in their kind of ranking of, you know, they've got defence, they've got etc. Is it kind of, yeah, where would you kind of place that, do you think?
I think a lot of things in government are what is going to present me with a problem. What is going to be, you know, you get told in government all the time, 10 times a week, someone will say, this could become a huge problem, but then 9 times out of 10, it doesn't, and the other one is generally manageable, or else it becomes coronavirus, so, or some sort of huge issue like that. So I think justice is ticking over. I think Robert is seen as a very safe pair of hands, someone who's not going to rock the boat, someone who's going to do a good job. There's going to be a new prisons minister, of course. Lucy Fraser was very, very good, very conscientious person. She's gone off to be Solicitor General, and there'll be change there. So I think that certainly the issue of terrorists in prison was, and terrorism as a result of being radicalised, was a huge issue and something that Boris Johnson was very concerned about, and something that Dominic Cummings and Boris acted very, very swiftly to increase sentences, to make sure people didn't get out. And increasing sentences of people who were already in prison in terms of the time they spent behind bars. So I think that was certainly something that was swiftly dealt with, but it was dealt with when it became a problem. So I think in terms of central government's focus on prisons overall, I think it's not huge. Although what's really interesting, there was a very good special advisor in number 10, called Blair Gibbs. He's now left, but Rory Gagan has taken over, and Rory is someone who's a former police officer, has worked at a think tank for many years as well, and he knows the criminal justice system really well. So I think there'll be a renewed focus on criminal justice at the highest level. So I think, you know, as Prime Minister, as senior special advisors in Downing Street, you can't know everything, you can't be doing everything at all times, and that's why you delegate to people. But I think the people who Boris Johnson has delegated to are very, very good.
Interesting. So do you see, I mean, I get the impression I'm kind of getting is that at that kind of governmental level, it's very much kind of predominantly reactive as opposed to proactive in terms of that. It's kind of, don't do anything that's going to fuck it up for this government, that's going to cause us any big problems. So let's just keep that ticking over quietly in the corner and deal with any problems as and when they come up. And I guess from a standpoint, it'd be interesting to get Claire's take, because you kind of work with, you really do kind of see the kind of tough end of that, of the system, you know, guys that are really, really struggling there, and kind of having gone through it myself, I guess you kind of see that there's this kind of systemic problem there. Claire, I guess it'd be interesting for you to kind of get your take on kind of what you would like to see change on a governmental level, maybe on a systemic level.
It's going to get too deep too quickly. No. I think there's a lot to say, isn't there, really, about so many of the individual issues themselves. And, you know, the longer term, you know, you've touched on so many of them there. So, you know, and I think from where I work, certainly as a campaigning organisation, the sort of turnaround of leadership is a problem, given that they don't always have much background knowledge of the area, and it can feel like you're sort of starting again from a campaigning point of view. So I haven't got a solution for you, really. I'm not sure if you were asking for it, but
yes, I was.
It's certainly very interesting to hear.
Yeah, I think, just because something isn't on Boris Johnson's desk every day, or even on Robert Buckland's desk every day, doesn't mean it's not being dealt with, doesn't mean it's not being adhered to. I suppose the question is really about reform and priorities for the government, because you can only do so much within the very short period that you're in government, or the very short period that you're in political office. And I think that's why, you know, most civil servants I worked with, about 95% of them, I would say, were really good, dedicated people who knew their stuff, and things are in safe hands. But Claire, of course, will know that if you want radical change, if you want radical budgetary change, if you want radical systematic change, that's got to come politically as well. And I suppose lobbying for that is very difficult, especially when, as we know, because for obvious reasons with Conservative voting patterns on Conservative voters, you need to remember what's politically acceptable and what, you know, you cannot be seen as a soft touch. But one thing that I actually dealt with a little bit, which I'd love to hear Claire's views on, was sobriety tags. So these were piloted, these were used in various parts of the world, including in London when Boris Johnson was mayor of London, and had a huge, a very, very successful rate of saying to people, right, you're on probation, and you know, you've got to have a sobriety tag, because alcohol obviously is so much part of many, many crimes, and the levels of recidivism were very, very low, which was great. But of course, you have people wearing a tag, the tags are expensive, you need to have people to monitor the tags and so on. But that's a policy where you're actually investing and you know, you're getting good results in keeping people out of prison. So I think, and you can sell the policy, which can be very, very difficult. You're not just banging people up for longer, you're actually trying to help keep them out of prison by keeping them away from something which often encourages them or assists them in some way. Maybe that's the wrong terminology in terms of committing crimes. So that to me was actually a really decent innovation that we were part of at the time. But I wonder what Claire thinks of that.
Tagging in general has not had a great reputation for how that has been achieved in recent years. But no, I don't know anyone. I haven't dealt with anyone specifically who's been subject to sobriety tagging. I know certainly in terms of GPS tagging and electronic monitoring has increased with the number of people that I'm seeing released from prison as a general license condition. And for the people I work with, I would say there's a general idea that that's a very significant infringement of liberty, and actually quite a lot of shame that comes along with a tag, in terms of it sort of being visible. Rob, were you on tag when you got early? So
yeah,
you must
I was
have been
on tag,
tag
for 4.5 months. So not a sobriety tag, just your regular HTC, which I was fine with. I mean, if it was that over another 4.5 months in Rochester, I was happy to, I wasn't too fussed about that. So yeah, I think it's an interesting one, isn't it? I think that kind of, that line to be drawn between, and I was going to say the line to be drawn between kind of what's effective and I guess if that's kind of data driven and we see that that kind of thing is successful, it's whether you purely base your decision making on what is effective at preventing people from reoffending. And I guess it's an interesting one, I think. So, I mean, what's your view, Claire? Would you say that, I mean, are you kind of anti that kind of thing? Do you feel that's kind of ineffective or shouldn't be? It's a kind of, I don't want to say breach of human rights, but do you know what I mean? I mean, that kind of is counterproductive in that sense.
I would always prefer a preventative measure. So I think that ideally we would have more money and resources into using that towards helping people with, for example, alcohol or substance misuse issues to prevent them going to prison, rather than seeing, you know, it can be a cause of crime rather than a, you know, seeing it from the other end. And that would be ideal. With a lot of things, you know, that includes mental health, that includes gambling, that includes, you know, a whole range of things. But a lot of those, that assistance is something which we're seeing a reduction of in sort of more recent times. So I think that's a problem. And I think sort of sticking it on the end and saying this prevents further offending can be tricky, but without going too far into it. So, no, I mean, I'm certainly up for, you know, of course, anything that does help people out of prison. We don't want people going on that roundabout of going back into prison for their own sake and for their families and for the, you know, it's something as simple as the cost and resources that it takes to manage that. So it does no one any good. But I think that sort of statistics can often be misleading about in what way they're preventing people or stopping reoffending. And ideally, it's about stopping them ever going into the system. And that's even goes back as far as police contact in the first instance. You know, that first time that you have police contact increases, you're likely to have further police contact. So that's where it all really needs to be in kind of stemming the flow of people going in the first place, if is my big picture answer.
I had one more question. So just on the kind of more general approach of the government in terms of, I guess, I think we've talked about it previously that the kind of two roles of people going into prison or the two purposes of people going in, there's the kind of punishment element and there's the rehabilitation element. It's kind of broadly, Claire, would you agree that's kind of, or fair enough, that's kind of the two kind of main reasons that people would see if someone going into prison?
I think they list more than that as the official reasons for prison. But deterrence.
Okay.
So to show as a deterrent to other people to prevent them committing crimes, which is what a lot of the increase in sentencing is often about. Okay. You know, if you look at knife crime, probably, you know, a lot of the larger, higher sentences are probably an attempt to scare people, other people from committing crime, whether or not it does or not.
Well, the knife crime and then the more serious crimes like lying about why you've flown to Portugal for a holiday this summer. So beware of those. I guess that's part of it. Watch out, boats. on your little hop off to Ibiza. But let's break it down. So if we've got the deterrent, but so I guess the kind of I would say in my head certainly, and I think probably in lots of the general public view, if you looked at, you know, think of what people are trying to achieve with prison, I think that probably would be the two elements. You think there should be a punishment element. Someone's committed a crime, they should be punished. And then I guess there is that idea that while someone is in prison, you would hope that there is some element of rehabilitation. How would you say in your broad experience, I guess it's kind of a vague question, so it might be difficult if we're not talking about specific individuals, but would you have said the kind of conservative approach leans one way or the other? Is it kind of very much more deterrent or punishment, or do you think there is a genuine desire to bring about rehabilitation and a kind of more progressive? Has that changed, or is that the case within Conservatives Party?
I think it has changed as Conservatives have become more liberal themselves. I mean, obviously, David Cameron even described himself as a liberal Conservative, and he appointed Ken Clark as Justice Secretary. I think what certainly plays well is, you know, increasing sentences and you know, a tough approach and deterrence and all the rest of it. But I think at the heart of that has to be the argument I always have, which is, you know, unless you're one of the fewer than 60 people in this country who has a whole life tariff, you're going to get out. What do we want for those people when they get out? What do we want them to have in their lives and their skill set and their mind? And it's got to be about rehabilitation. It's got to be about, you know, there's so many people who go to prison and it's the first structure they've had in their life. It's the first deadlines they've had in their life. It's the first kind of time they've been told, right, now you must go to bed. There will be lights out at this time. So it's really very, very difficult, I think, for people to come out and then have no structure in their life. I think, you know, Conservatives will acknowledge that a lot more and realise that a lot more and realise that we've got to prevent people reoffending. Definitely. We've got to prevent them, as Claire correctly says, getting there in the first place. And preventative measures need to be brought in. But I think there's probably more appetite for and more sort of hard-nosed opinion on ex-offenders and what we kind of do with them. And I think there's a really, you know, things like Timpson, for example, are very, very much lauded within government, and schemes like that, giving people essentially a second chance to be, you know, productive members of society. And I think that is the kind of thing we need to develop. I think there are a number of organizations, including the civil service, actually, who will take in ex-offenders and will give them apprenticeships and give them training and perhaps even a job at the end of that. And that's a very, very good thing and something we need to do more of, because there are, of course, many people, and you know, I'm talking to two of them now, who've made bad decisions and then have made good decisions to not make bad decisions anymore and to really turn your life around. And that is to be really, really applauded. And just because you have a past doesn't mean you can't have a future. And I think we need to have that at the very core of justice policy in this country.
Peter, we ask all of our guests two specific questions. And I think one of those questions you will have, I imagine, more to say on than most, and certainly probably a more appropriate background to answer it. So maybe we'll give you some time. We shouldn't have sprung it on you. You might have too much to say. So one of those questions is, if you could change anything about the criminal justice system with no budgetary concerns and no, you know, red tape, what would it be?
I would love to have a team for every single prisoner to say, why did you commit crime? What are the factors in your life outside that led you to do that? What is the element of personal responsibility you need to take for simply just making a bad decision? And what are the kind of structures that we need to put in place, whether that's housing, a job, keeping you away from people who are going to tempt you back into a life of crime again? Government can't sort out everybody's life. It's impossible, because there are limited resources and also people need to take personal responsibility. But there are many, many people in our society who don't have perhaps the resources, the intelligence perhaps, or the structure around them to take control of their lives. In an ideal world, I would take every prisoner, assess them, work out what, you know, 3 years inside, what are we going to do in those 3 years? How are we going to work strategically, work backwards to get you to a place that when you leave this place, you never come back? That would be my ideal. But that's, you know, complete fantasy land, probably.
I like that. You got the politician's handout there for the first time. We saw those ones. That was good to see. I like that. No, very good answer. No, I think... And the good news is there shouldn't be any budgetary issues in the next kind of 5-10 years. We should be good for cash. So we can get that cracking. Boris is listening. Robert Buckland's listening. Let's get going.
Boats, do the honour of the second question.
What's that, the room one?
Yeah.
What's
yeah,
that?
Yeah,
have you yeah, been exactly. here this series?
Yeah.
Peter, if obviously I know you're never gonna end up in jail, but if you did for whatever reason end up in prison, who would be your ideal / dream cellmate? It could be a woman as well.
My dream cellmate. Oh gosh. Oh, I've no idea. Wow. Someone who could tunnel their way out. I don't know. Dream cellmate, if I had to spend a long time with one person. Probably my old boss, actually, James Brokenshire. He'd be a great cellmate, because he's a really nice guy, and he would never be in prison. He would never be in a country mile of, I mean, he's the most kind of upstanding, law-abiding person I've ever come across in my entire life. But he'd be good fun to spend a couple of years with, definitely. Because I spent, actually, when you're a special advisor, you often spend, you know, much more time with your bosses than they do their family. So maybe that feels a similar level of intensity sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's certainly the question. I remember in my interview, actually, for my first special advising job, I said to James, actually, I said, the question you need to ask yourself is, can you spend 24 hours in an airport with me? And I would imagine being in a cell is perhaps a slightly longer version of that.
Yeah, well, just a bit.
Yeah, I think
that's quite impressive for a boss yeah. to win that prize.
I was about to say, I don't know what's going to divide our audience more, whether it's, you know, the fact that you're a Tory or the fact you've said your dream cellmate would be your boss. So I think that will, that will definitely split decisions, I think.
And what do other people say to that? I mean, am I meant to say, like, I don't know, you know, Scarlett Johansson or whatever? Like, what's the...
No, we've had all sorts. We've had Arsene Wenger. I think Arsene Wenger was one, wasn't it? Which, I'm not sure how Arsene would feel about that. 365 days of having his brains picked about. you know, why he bought Gael Clichy. We've had, who else have we had? Who else did we have? I can't remember now. I think we've had kind of, we've had a few people that we've had on that were inmates have said, old cellmates, boat said me.
No, I didn't.
Interestingly, we've never had a family member. No one's ever said anyone from their own family.
It's true, isn't it?
There's no way.
Yeah, I don't think I could.
No, if I had my mother or my brother, I would commit another offence.
Yeah, I think that's a fair bit of that.
Exactly.
25 years at least.
Exactly. Yeah.
Peter, I mean, what a really fascinating insight into kind of a side of within the justice system that we haven't really covered so far. So yeah, it's, I mean, really, really interesting and so good to hear kind of your experiences and your kind of depth of knowledge has been. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing that
thank
with
you
us.
So much.
Probably a good chance to give you a plug. You have got a book out, I believe, you know, which you've kept quiet up until now.
I do. It's called The Secret Life of Special Advisors. And you can get it from bookshops or online. And it's a really light book. It's not going to change your life. It's not going to intellectually challenge you. It's just funny stories about being in government, about one of a cabinet secretary who was twerking to Stormzy at the Brit Awards, for example, and about why I once spent 8 days talking about ovens. So that's all in there. But it's hopefully a good fun book.
Fantastic. Well, go out. I'm sure. Well, not going to change your life. Lots of funny stories. Sounds like a perfect fit for this podcast. So, Peter, thanks very much for coming on. It's been great
having you.
You've been a fantastic guest. And all the very best for the future, whatever you do. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So, Boats, you've heard the episode now. Anything else you want to?
I was lost for words. That's why I didn't speak much. I was lost for words. It was a lot of information to take in. So,
like a sponge, aren't you, Boats?
Just absorbing. Just absorbing, yeah.
Very good. Very good.
I thought he was really interesting. He's a really, really nice, really, really nice guy.
Well, it was good to hear from someone on the inside a bit more, wasn't it?
Exactly. I like what you've done there, Claire. Clever wordplay. Really, really nice guy. And yeah, really interesting to hear. Should we do? I've got a couple of reviews. Do you want to hear
them? Tell us.
Boats does.
Yeah, always. Only good ones.
Claire, would you like
are there any bad ones?
Excellent. It's taken as read that Boats wants to hear the review. He's probably read them already.
He's writing them.
So what have we got? Good start on this one. So this is Fisher 66. Fantastic podcast. Rob and Boatsy, both honest and open about the whole experience. Really like season 2. Is that right or a bit Sky TV? Keep it up, Matt. No, it's fine. You can roll with that. We are pretty corporate these days. We're quite mainstream. Whatever works. Next one is Charlie Ron 40. Have absolutely binge listened to this. That is the way to do it. So easy to listen to. Love the trio and love how busy Rob is. They've let themselves down a bit at the end there. Didn't need to put that last bit on, did they? That was unnecessary. But yeah, otherwise, nice review. Keep those coming. So jump on wherever you listen to the pod. Can you review on Spotify? Maybe just Apple. But
you know what is funny? Even like my mates that have listened to it, they do love you because they're like, everyone knows a busy prick. Everyone knows everyone knows a little busy bud.
I think that's what they call a backhanded compliment, Boats.
I'll take it.
We also had a nice message actually on Instagram come through. I won't say who it was, but we had message from someone saying, just want to say a massive thank you to you guys. I was actually preparing to go inside and I used your podcast as both a coping and preparation mechanism. Oh. Thankfully managed to get a suspended sentence, but still your podcast has been a huge help. That's nice to know. I mean, crisis averted. He's done well there to get a suspended sentence.
Let's hope it stays suspended.
He's had a touch.
Yeah, exactly. Do let us know if you break your terms, you end up inside. Yeah, keep us posted on that one. Good to know.
Good to know. And who have we got next week?
Mike. Is it Mike?
It's Mike.
From one Michael to another.
Yeah.
It is. We've tried to mix up the series. This was a bit different. This was someone that had been a lifelong criminal, fair to say. Not lifelong, because he's not anymore, we should point out. But he had
a career criminal, as they say.
I want to say 60s and 70s 80s. He was a fascinating story. Michael Emmett, and had it's lived about 15 lives. We heard 9 of them on the pod.
And he could have carried on talking for another.
Yeah, we could still be there, I think. Fascinating guy. Some, yeah, unbelievable stories going in there. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that one as well.
And you're going to put out an Instagram. Now you're on an Instagram roll, you're going to put out another question. This week, we're going to ask what we've asked all of our guests at the end. Following on from Peter, who was involved with, you know, policy, this is the moment we thought, let's ask our listeners what they would change. What one thing would you change in the criminal justice system if you could? So we've heard from our guests what they would do, but we're interested to hear from you. So Rob will put the question up on Instagram and reply there, and we'll hear from some people next week.
Happy days.
Fantastic.
Happy days.
Yeah, keep an eye on the Instagram. I'm on fire at the moment, so it probably will go up at some point this week.
When you do the selfie videos, it kills me, you know.
Well, you say that. Everyone's a critic, aren't they, Boats? But if people want to scroll back down our grid a little bit, they will see a little gem from series one of the one and only Michael Boateng doing a little piece to camera, so they can compare and contrast there.
Maybe if we get enough likes on it, he'll do another one.
Exactly, that's it. Okay, yeah, if we get some more likes on that video, if you want to hear some more, see another polished selfie video from Boat, go back through the grid, like and comment on that video. And if we get
what's
more
your
than
number, Boats? Three, what's your number that you'll
like, he'll do another one.
300.
Yeah. All right, we'll hold
30.
You to it.
We'll meet in the middle. 30. If we get more than 30 comments in the next week, Boats will do another one.
Yeah, but you're going to start making fake accounts and just start commenting. That's what you're going to do.
Trolling you.
But now
get the
I'm
bots
going
out.
To. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Great idea. I like where your head's at, Boats.
Right. Well, awesome. Watch this space then.
Watch this space
and see you next week.
See you next week.
Have a good one.
See you next week, guys.